Hello, I'm Jane Crowther and welcome to the subscriber version of Inside Total Film. And thank you for taking out a subscription. You should have your John Wick 3 cover in the post to you right now. And today I'm joined by one of our contributing editors, Leila Latif.
Hello.
Hello. This week we are chatting to Antonio Banderas about Puss in Boots: The Last Wish, as well as Brendan Fraser and Darren Aronofsky about The Whale. We'll be rating both of those movies, plus M. Night's Knock at the Cabin, festival favourite Saint Omer, and another film with donkeys, Io. But before we get on to those, Leila, what have you been watching this week? We've been at Sundance, haven't we? So what have you been feasting your eyes on there?
Oh, yeah, virtual Sundance. I mean, it is always so good the way that they set up the platform and everything. So another great year, I think a really good selection of films. A lot of highlights, actually. Fair Game, I really, really enjoyed, which is a kind of erotic thriller. I suppose they're calling it an erotic thriller. It's not that erotic, but it's about kind of a really toxic couple that are both working in finance, and the competition between them starts to get to them. So it's like really interesting on gender politics, and you know, they're both quite unlikable in some ways, him much more so than her, but you know, it's really tense and really, really good performances in that one.
A lot of good, like, terminology that we don't understand still, you know, like margin call hasn't helped us out, The Big Short hasn't helped. What are they talking about when they're talking about finances? Are you any the wiser?
Absolutely not. And it's a bit like I've been watching Succession for years, but I have no idea how hostile takeovers work as well. That bit I'm able to just kind of in one ear, out the other. Yeah. But still, character-wise, as a thriller, absolutely great. I also really love the rom-com You Hurt My Feelings, which stars Julie Louise Dreyfus with the director who did that wonderful comedy Enough Said with her and James Gandolfini. And that's about a woman who overhears her husband talking about how he thinks her new book is absolutely dreadful. It's just, it's really good and really, really funny. And then, yeah, one that you recommended on Twitter was I Really Like to Talk to Me. That was a pretty
well, you say
grisly
like
one.
It's hard to like it, isn't it? It's terrifying.
Terrifying, really, really disturbing, and like, you know, really disgusting in a lot of parts. But yeah, felt like a kind of interesting new direction for horror, because we've had a lot of these kind of, are they really horror films? This is just kind of a bit of a metaphor sort of thing. And there was a bit of that around as well. So it was quite interesting to see something that was kind of going back to kind of a previous nastier era.
Yeah, this is just kids that have a horrible, haunted, possessed hand that allows them to be possessed by a spirit for 90 seconds. And of course, you shouldn't really go beyond that limit, should you? And what would you do if you'd seen horror films and knew the rules of horror? You would keep very closely to that 90-second rule. But of course, they don't. And yeah, there's some pretty gruesome scenes in it that I actually had to watch through my fingers.
Yeah, same. It is impressive, a horror film that I did buy, that these kids were stupid enough to do it in the first place, because it's actually really horrible, even if they just do the 90 seconds.
Yes.
Like, I have no idea why this would happen more than once.
Yeah, you'd be like, we are never doing that again. That was horrific. But it's about peer pressure. You know, I know you said it's not really trying to tap into other themes, but there is a theme of grief and guilt and peer pressure, and the sort of the idea that if everyone else is doing something, you want in, whether that's a good idea or not. So there are sort of certain things playing around the edges of it. But yeah, essentially, it's just really grim, terrifying visuals. Yeah, I'm still thinking about a particular scene with a young boy who should not have gone longer than 90 seconds. It involved eye.
Yeah, no, but and it starts off pretty gnarly as well.
Yeah, like, the first scene. Kind of,
so it's like, I think within like the first 5 minutes, you are like, okay, strap yourself in. This is going to be tough. I think it comes together really well. A really strong ending, which often these kind of higher concept things don't really have. So yeah, that was a great one. Oh, and also got to say Jonathan Majors in Magazine Days.
Well, yes, Dreams, Magazine Dreams.
Oh, sorry. That is not a good title, but it's a good film.
Yeah, Jonathan Majors. That was my favourite of the festival, Magazine Dreams, about a bodybuilder, wannabe bodybuilder, who is disconnected from everybody, has a very tragic past, cannot connect with his co-workers or a potential girlfriend, doesn't seem to operate well in the world, is full of roid rage as well as other kinds of rage, is a stan, is punishing his body for some sort of sins he feels it's sort of done by trying to make it this perfect specimen. And he does a good job. I mean, Majors is in like this incredible shape. It's a physical performance, but also this incredible internal performance that, yeah, I'm like, if he is not on Oscar lists next year, I don't know what's going on, because he should be. That's astonishing. It's like Taxi Driver, Eminem's Stan video, all sorts of, it has the tension of like Uncut Gems, tension of Calm with Horses, what is going to happen, when is this going to boil over. I just thought it was an incredible film.
And I think when you look like Jonathan Majors does, and he's also very like charismatic normally, that you buy that this guy is a complete outsider, and that actually he's someone that can't work and kind of operate normally within society. He's just extraordinary. I thought amazing.
Bodes well for Kang, doesn't it, in Ant-Man, and what we'll see from him, because Kang is supposed to be even more of a badass than Thanos. And for us to believe that, it takes a pretty special actor. So I'm quite excited to see what Majors does with that.
And just kind of on the opposite end, because a lot of those films are quite upsetting, but Polite Society was so much fun. I think it's from the woman who made We Are Lady Parts, and she's kind of made a action comedy about a young girl that wants to become a stunt woman and feels that she needs to save her sister from a disastrous marriage, which sounds like a kind of stiff drama. It's absolutely not. It is more kind of like Edgar Wright-esque, kind of really loads of action, really silly, bit of sci-fi in there too. I mean, I love that one.
Yes, all of these films will be out later this year, we hope. Although sometimes the stragglers don't ever appear. Who knows? But I think these are all really strong films that we will see in cinemas. Shall we have a look and see what we can actually see on a big screen this week? It's time to find out if this is the cat's pajamas.
What's your story?
My story.
What are we looking at?
Cats have 9 lives. Watch! Watch! Watch!
Boss! I think you set the oven too high!
Now I am on my last life.
Oh no!
Holy shooting star!
Legend tells of a wishing star, of a single wish waiting to be granted.
Kitties of Boss, I need your help.
Is the great Puss in Boots asking for help?
Well, you see, Kitty, please!
That wish will get me my life's back.
This is Puss in Boots, the last wish. Layla, what is his last wish?
So we meet Puss, who is he kind of ends up fighting this like kind of giant that's like a monster. And we learn at the end of it, as he gets kind of crushed, that he's only got one life left. Cats have 9 lives, and now he's down to his final one. So he kind of can't live in this kind of risk-taking way, because like if something happens again, you know, that's it for Puss. So he kind of goes and lives a much more quiet life, but he you know, as this is a Puss in Boots adventure, there's a wolf that appears, and then a crime family involving Goldilocks and the Three Bears, and he kind of gets the opportunity to go on another quest.
Shall we hear from Puss himself before we sort of claw apart that film and toss it around like a toy between cats? Let's hear what he had to say himself about slipping the tiny cat boots back on when Molly Edwards sat down with Antonio Banderas earlier this week.
How was it pitched to you? And like, did you really jump at the chance to come back to the character? Because it's been such a long time since you last played him. Like, it's been over 10 years since the first movie. So what was it like to just come back?
During all these 10 years between the last one and this one, I was always in contact with DreamWorks. You know, the studio moved to Universal also, but the producers were the same ones that, you know, they called me to do this version. But the initial script for this version changed enormously. And I think, in a way, because of the events that happened in the world, on the COVID situation and all the reflection that brought to, you know, everybody who was involved in writing the script. So it started getting, you know, different in a way. It was very pleasant, actually, to see that they're there with no restrictions to talk about death, which is a natural thing that happens to all humans. Because kids also, they were in a way victims of COVID. They were in confinement. They were just questioning themselves, what is going on out there? What is affecting everybody so much? Why I cannot go to school? Why I cannot do this? Why I cannot see my friends? What is death? The movies for kids, you know, allow themselves to reflect about this. I think it's important. And so I felt very proud. You know, I know what it had to do also with me, because I had a health scare, you know, like 5 years ago. And also, you know, I saw myself reflected in the life of Postmodes. I have something in common with the character, finally.
You're talking about like the theme of death in the film, and we have this brilliant antagonist in The Last Wish, the wolf, who is genuinely just so scary and chilling. So like, how did you find kind of delving into those scenes when Puss is confronting him? Because the character is usually so fearless, but we see him really terrified here.
You know, but what I remember is that when I was a kid, I needed, this is something probably that I realized years later, but I needed that the bad guy was really believable. I remember, for example, one of my favorite movies of all times when I was a kid was Peter Pan. And I remember, you know, Captain Hook to be, you know, a strong character. And so that gave me the pleasure of, as a spectator, you know, just to see how Peter Pan can control that and can fight that and win at the end. If the bad character, the villain, is weak, it wouldn't really make sense to me. Yeah, definitely. There are moments in which, you know, when he's following him in the forest, he gets really scary.
Also, this like amazing voice cast in The Last Wish, like along with yourself, obviously, you were reunited with Salma Hayek, Pinot, and you also had Florence Pugh, Ray Winston, so many more incredible actors.
They're brilliant actors.
Did you get to spend a lot of time like recording with them, actually? Like,
No. The system has been always, in the 20 years that we were, you record alone. Normally, we have somebody to feed you lines from the other characters. And the only time that I did something with somebody else, it was in the first movie, Puss in Boots, alone, already in the spin-off. I asked to do it with Salma because we are really very good friends. And I knew that we could improvise. And I know how feisty she is. and so we got some good stuff. It was funny and it was real. Many people think that we just dubbed in the movie, that it's an ADR process, but it's not. Your voice goes first. And so you are totally free to do whatever the heck you know.
And congratulations as well on the Best Animated Picture nomination for The Last Wish. Was this level of awards recognition like something you were expecting, or has that just been a really pleasant surprise?
You have to think that from everybody who goes to the Academy Awards and sit down in those chairs, almost 85% are losers that night. Only a very little amount of those people that are going to win. So, and it's very subjective. Minority movies that I love, they probably didn't do a great box office and probably they didn't receive so many awards, but I got those movies in my brain forever. And so, yeah, but yeah, it's great.
That's a good way of looking at it. And So kind of in like a similar line, this film is going to cinemas rather than going straight to streaming like some other animated films have recently. Do you feel really passionate about this being seen on a big screen?
Yeah. I invited my whole entire cast in the theater and the technicians and the musicians that are playing with us every night. And they all brought their kids. And it was so much fun just to watch it on a big screen with great sound. And wow. They flipped out. They were just cheering and it was great. So, yeah.
I also want to ask you just quickly about you're in Indiana Jones 5. And I know you said before the role is kind of like a cameo, but I just want to know, like, what was it like working with Harrison Ford back in such an iconic role for the last time for him? So what was that experience like?
It was beautiful to just be close to him. I remember the first time I saw Indiana Jones and I flipped out. But it's not a bad guy, he's a friend of Indiana, I mean, but he's not very big. But just that my name is attached to Indiana Jones. If my daughter has a baby someday, I can tell him, you know, Grandpa did a movie with Indiana Jones.
So that's Antonio talking about inhabiting the cat. Does it work for you, Layla? Did this story work?
I was really pleasantly surprised by this. I think kind of so far down from the Shrek films and all of this, you do sometimes worry that they're just trying to milk every dollar possible out of this franchise. But I found it really, really moving and funny, and I really enjoyed it. I went with my son. I would say that I missed 10 minutes of this because at one point he found it so upsetting that I had to take him out for a little bit. But he calmed down and we got back in and we got to see Puss triumph. I think he was very, very worried that something bad was going to happen to Puss. Yeah, it's surprising. surprisingly profound, I guess. Like, yeah, all of the stuff around person facing his mortality was, yeah, really well written. The voice cast is amazing. I love Florence Pugh as Goldilocks. And I think it's Harvey Guillen who's who plays Guillermo in What We Do in the Shadows. It's this little therapy dog who kind of is like incredibly optimistic, but he reminds me a bit of Olaf from the Frozen films, but yeah, in a good way. Yeah, I found Ray Winston a little bit distracting because I think Ray Winston is so Ray Winston that I can't buy him as a bear. He's just, oh, Ray Winston is talking, but that's a minor quibble. Great family fun, this one.
Yeah, surprisingly good. It really felt like it delved really into everything we know of Puss up to now, but it also talks on a total level to the adults that would be accompanying children to this. You know, facing your mortality is something we all can totally relate to, mm-hmm, and a quest with a tiny hairless dog. But the animation as well is beautiful in this. They've really gone for a different look that's sort of reminiscent of the TV show, if you've ever watched the TV show Puss in Boots, that sort of more roughly hewn, psychedelic, painterly, I suppose, type of animation. And that's beautiful. But this wolf, I know, was it the wolf that scared your little boy? Because the wolf that comes in is the sort of harbinger of doom, the creature from the afterlife, the darkness that we all feel sits on our shoulder. And it is quite alarming, but deliciously so, I found. And then, of course, you've got the return of Kitty Softpaws, who doesn't love Salma Hayek, you know, doing her thing, sparring, yep, with Banderas. You know, they have such great chemistry, whether you can see them on a screen as real people or as cats. They have brilliant chemistry. So there's that. And this sadness as well in that relationship, that they're trying to mend this hurt that almost feels Quentin Tarantino-esque in this sort of trying to, the bride almost trying to come back and fix something that happened to her. No spoilers, but every single character in this has a genuine arc and journey that holds, mm-hmm, up and is brilliant. Yeah, I just think it's tremendous fun. And I can understand why it's in an awards conversation for animation, which I would not have thought having seen the very first Puss in Boots film.
Yeah, I mean, I rewatched Shrek about a year ago and I was actually struck by how ugly I thought it was. So it was kind of nice to see how much further they've come along, because I end up watching so many kids shows and there's a few of them where you can just see no thought has been put into this. It's just like a computer screensaver or something. But yeah, this was, the animation's so dynamic, you know, lots of the characters, like, you know, they're quite unusual looking, like John Mulaney plays a kind of feared pastry chef crime lord, yeah, guy. And he's a really unusual looking character, but it kind of works because it just feels stylish.
Has a very strange haircut that won't be catching on. But yeah, you know, we still have those sort of glimpses to the fairy tale land, but this is very much far removed from Shrek's world, which I really enjoyed. And the pursuit of this wish, that everybody's looking for a wish. And then how do you operate as a group when somebody needs it more than somebody else? And that is really, really interesting dynamics. So yes, highly recommend this, not just for kids, I would say.
No, I definitely not just for kids. And yeah, it is a really, really fun film. And I did see an interview with Eddie Murphy recently saying that he would be very interested in bringing back Donkey for some films. And I was like, yeah, sure.
I would
be
into
really
that.
Nice to see.
I love Donkey. I want to know what's happened with him and the dragon. Are they still married? What's happened to the kids? Has it got teenage dragon donkey kids that are causing them problems? I'm into it. Yeah. And also donkeys are a theme. You know, we had a little Jenny, the donkey in Banshees. We've got a donkey film this week. Donkeys are vogue. Get it back. Let's get Donkey the movie going. Go on, Eddie Murphy, I say.
Yeah. And that poor little donkey from Triangle of Sadness. Oh. Well, I don't think you actually see it. I think you mostly just hear, but yeah.
But there is some braying, distressed braying that is heard. And yes, that is, I'd forgotten about that donkey. And now you've reminded me and I'm sad again. Anyway, on that note, I think we are saying, please do go and see Puss in Boots. You won't regret it, whether you're 8 or 80. It's out in cinemas this Friday. Right, from one film facing death to another now, very different. It's this.
My name's Leonard. Well, it's nice to meet you. here?
I suppose I'm here to make friends with you. And your dad's too. But my heart is broken.
Why is it broken?
Because of what I have to do today.
So this is Knock at the Cabin. Essentially does what it says on the tin at the beginning. But how, Layla?
Oh, yeah, it's a very dark premise. But so there's a lovely couple, I think Leonard and Eric, and they have a beautiful adopted daughter. And they go away to a cabin to kind of, you know, relax. And they get a knock at the cabin from a group, the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, kind of led by this incredible man mountain that is Dave Bautista. And they're given the most terrible choice that they have to choose one family member to sacrifice. If not, the apocalypse will happen and all of humanity will die. So it's kind of kill a family member or everybody dies. So yeah, parts of it are kind of a bit like Funny Games. I mean, I do love that film, but it's kind of quite different because, you know, like Dave Bautista and Nicky Amukabird, they don't want to be doing this. They're not sadists. They don't take any joy in the idea of this happening, but they just, you know, they're trying to save the world.
Yes. So they're a teacher, a gas worker, a chef, and a nurse. And they have had visions that have brought them to this place, and a lot of the film is convincing this family that they're not just completely crazy, that this is a reality. And it does sort of toggle between the, is this nonsense, are they bananas, or is this reality? And if it is reality, then do you still have to make that choice, and can you make that choice, and how would you make that choice? So I really like the tension of the trying to work out if this is even reality, because who amongst us would believe four people that turn up and very sort of quietly say to you, hi, yeah, sorry, we've turned up. You need to kill one of you because otherwise everyone will die and the skies will rain fire and it will all go wrong and everybody will die and you'll be responsible for the entire world being killed. Who amongst us wouldn't say, quote your source, where is this coming from? You know, like, what, how, why would I believe you? This is nonsense. So I loved that sort of, that movement through that argument and how that would be proved. But I found that the proof that was supplied to be incredibly lacking.
Yeah, from what I understand, I haven't read the book, but it's quite a different ending from the novel. Okay, I don't want to give absolutely anything away or even hint at it.
No spoilers.
Let's just say it doesn't do necessarily the thing that M. Night is best known for. But I just think he's such a great filmmaker. I just enjoy the way that he moves the camera. I love like the way that he kind of builds tension. It's very taut. I mean, it's very... It's 90 minutes for me.
Yeah.
But my biggest thing I left with is like, Dave Bautista, you are a movie star. And it's funny because the last issue of Total Film, I wrote about how kind of do movie stars exist anymore? Then you see someone like him. He's such an incredible actor. I think he's definitely the best former wrestler.
Former wrestler
that
yeah.
became an actor.
Yeah, no, I mean, he's doing some incredibly nuanced stuff here because he has to be threatening. He has to be determined, but also he's a teacher. He's nurturing. He's kind. He really wants you to make this decision. Because the other part of this decision, which we probably should mention, is no one can kill them for them. The family members have to kill the one that's going to die. So it's a horrific decision. It's a bit like the box, or remember the box that where you a thing would arrive on your doorstep and you had to press it and you'd kill someone. But this is much more up close and personal. It's not that you don't know the person or it's a random person, which is a horrible enough decision on its own. This is you choose the person in your family that you love, that you think should die, and you kill them. And he navigates that with such humanity and tenderness, which is a weird thing to say when he's got like a pitchfork and other weapons with him. But it is quite a tightrope for an actor to walk, and he manages that. So yeah, fair play, Dave Bautista. I did find it quite cruel and unnecessarily violent. I know that's weird when we are talking about killing people, but it left me not feeling uplifted or my God, humans are amazing, but just depressed. And I'm not sure that was the intent of M. Night. And also there were elements of it as well that logically took me out of it, where I'd be like, well, that doesn't seem in real world like that would happen. and, you know, I have questions about air traffic control and other things when certain things happen that took me out of it. So on that level, it didn't totally work for me. But on tension and the sort of denouement of what would you do, which is a, you know, a very delicious and enticing thing, I think audience members will get a lot out of it and be able to talk about it afterwards.
Yeah, it's definitely the bleakest thing that I think he's ever done. But, yeah, you know, he's just a filmmaker I really admire. And I think he's kind of got the chops to do it. And I love that kind of in this world where we get kind of so many blockbusters and loads of them are great, but just kind of you got people like Baz Luhrmann or M. Night who come up and they're so kind of marching to the beat of their own drum and making, you know, quite unusual films in many ways. And they do well at the box office. So I'm kind of, yeah.
But we should always rooting less for them. Said about old, the better, though.
Disagree. I think old was a riot.
Well, yes.
But yes, could see that that was divisive, but I had a lot of fun with old. This is less silly than old, certainly.
Yeah, he's operating in a sort of Jordan Peele world where he's just making films that he knows work, irrespective of fashion or trends or genres. And so from that point of view, it is nice to see somebody producing this kind of work that is, it is IP, it is taken from a book, it's not a franchise, it's not a reboot, it's something unique. And yeah, in a world that is bleak at the moment with the news, maybe this is what you do want to watch. I don't know, but I found it quite depressing.
Well, shame. He seems like such a nice man. I'm sure he'd apologize if he knew that he'd depressed you.
But then at least I felt something coming out and I wasn't bored. So yeah, it is a trigger warning, I suppose, for anyone who's doesn't enjoy home invasion. That's not, this is not going to help with that anxiety, but it is definitely one that's worth watching and discussing afterwards. Do you reckon?
Yeah. And I also made me kind of look at my family a little bit afterwards, being just like, you guys would vote for me, wouldn't you?
Oh, I thought you were going to say something more bleak, like deciding which one was going to go and which one you were going to shovel in the head.
No, I reckon they'd team up against me. Yeah.
Yeah, Layla's the one that's going to save the world with her sacrifice, just so everyone knows for future reference, if Dave Bautista comes calling. It could be much quicker and simpler than the drawn out process in this film. It can be less than 90 minutes in deciding this.
Yeah,
right.
Type 15.
Okay, so that is Knock at the Cabin and it's out in cinemas this Friday. Right. Time for a courtroom drama with a difference. It's this.
C'est l'heure des hautes marées. La lune se dresse devant moi. Mon projecteur, comme un appel de phare. Alors j'allais sur la plage.
Madame Colly, savez-vous pourquoi vous avez tué votre fille?
Je ne le sais pas. J'espère que ce procès pourra me l'apprendre.
So this is Saint Omer. Layla, you are a total fangirl for this and the director. Tell us about it.
Oh, yeah. The president of the Alice Diop Fan Society is right here with you. So, yeah, this is a film that Alice Diop, the director, the story, kind of the story building up to it is quite interesting. So she was pregnant with her first child. She had made a lot of documentaries and she just found out about this case where a woman from Senegal had been accused of murdering her daughter on a beach in kind of the north of France. And she was so interested in this because she felt like, oh, the way it's being reported on is racist. This might be like, you know, a previous French case that she had been interested in where the mother was falsely accused. So she goes and she's going to watch the entire trial. Everything that she expected to find was not as she did. And so she kind of came away at the end of it and decided, okay, I'm going to make this into a film. So we kind of have Rama, who is in this kind of a professor and a novelist who's playing basically a version of Alice Diop, and who hears about a murder case and decides that maybe she's going to write a kind of modern Medea-esque story about this woman who has murdered her little baby, a 15-month-old baby, by leaving her kind of on the beach and letting the tide come in. It's absolutely horrific. But then she can't really understand this woman because she's, you know, a PhD student, supposedly, who has studied Wittgenstein, but also she's saying that witchcraft was perhaps involved in why she murdered her daughter. Most of the film is Rama just simply watching testimony from people. So watching Laurence Cully talk about why she did the things, her partner comes on, previous people. And it's a very, very empathetic film. Even the judge, you know, the lawyers and stuff, they do seem to really want to understand. And Laurence herself is saying that, like, oh, I'm at this trial because I want to know why this happened as well. But yeah, as you imagine, a film about a woman murdering her baby is incredibly sad at times. There's a speech at the end about kind of the monstrosity of women that just had me in floods. Watched it like maybe 5 or 6 times. And it's interesting because Alice Diop herself has a really hard time talking about this film because, you know, she finds it very upsetting as well. But it's incredible. I wasn't allowed to put it as my film of the year last year because it technically came out this year, but it would have been.
It can still be for this year at the end of the year when we do our roundup. Would you think it's going to ride high for the whole of the year? Is it something that's haunted you? I mean, we saw it in Venice. Is it going to continue to haunt you for the rest of this year, I reckon?
Definitely for me, it's going to stay with me. I very few weeks go past that I don't kind of have a little 10-minute think about this film and just how kind of astonishing it is. I mean, for me, I'm going to keep flying that Alice Diop is you know, one of the great directors of our age flag for as long as I can. And such a stylish woman. I just love everything about her.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, babies drowning on beaches is something that is horrific. If you've ever seen Under the Skin, that scene destroyed me. So this, as a just a concept, is very upsetting. But yeah, as you say, the thing that is interesting about this is the tenderness of everybody involved to try to understand why this happened. And, you know, we're in a world where this does happen. It's not an anomaly. Mothers do kill their children. And why does that happen? And what is it that drives it? And what sort of lack of control in their lives forces them into an impossible position where this is an outcome? So from that point of view, it's incredibly interesting to anyone that's ever read a newspaper headline and wondered that. It really explores that. But also, you know, just to see representation of a France that is getting more representation on screen now, but hasn't. You know, in the past, we've just seen, you know, a lot of Parisian white people enjoying wine in bars. And we're now seeing a much more diverse French community that lives and breathes in France. So from that point of view, it's really exciting to see as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think even in the kind of being introduced to Rama, I found it so interesting that in some way she is that Parisian, very chic French woman because, you know, she's so stylish and she's so glamorous and she's, you know, at this kind of, you know, big building in France giving like lectures on, I think it's Marguerite Duras, maybe, I can't remember. You know, then when she goes and she's with her Senegalese family, she actually feels a little bit kind of out of place, like they're kind of watching things in Wolof, which she doesn't really understand. And she doesn't seem to really connect with them. But then also when she's in Saint-Omer, this northern town, she's sort of a fish out of water too, you know, because the town is quite shabby and is very white. And like, you can see that she doesn't really fit in there as well. And I think that's just so subtly but brilliantly done, because Rama basically spends most of the film unable to talk because she's sitting in a courtroom just watching, but you still completely understand her kind of the tensions and the difficulties that she has in her life and her identity.
Yeah, and you know, we talked about Dave Bautista's performance, you know, being able to create an entire character out of not very much. The same is true here. There's some really good active listening going on here. You know, as you say, she doesn't have a lot to say, but she is listening and you feel all her emotions watching her do that, which is quite the achievement as well.
Yeah, I have to say, I do think that this is a very sad and very serious film. I think there is one very, very funny moment in it because, you know, she makes unusual choices with what she's going to show you and not show you. It's not kind of a typical courtroom film, but there's one bit where a male kind of barrister starts speaking and she just cuts off after like 10 seconds as if to be like, we don't care what this guy has to say.
Yes, I didn't think that was humorous, but now you've put it that way, I do see, yeah, maybe that is a comment on this. I mean, it's a feminist film, isn't it? It's about understanding women and the pressures on them. All types of women from different walks of life. And, you know, the fact that the judge is a woman as well. It's there to promote a conversation about every aspect of this, don't you think?
Yeah, it's a wonderful piece of art. So I think that it wasn't too heavy-handed in terms of feminist messaging. You must go and kind of see the errors of your ways.
It might sound off-putting, maybe, the way we've talked about it. It feels like a really heavy film, but it's just like a really kind film in a way. And It's about talking to each other and understanding each other at the end of the day, which is something everyone can relate to. So that is Saint Omer, which is out in cinemas on Friday. Right, on to the next film. Is this the best actor winner at this year's awards ceremonies? Let's discuss. It's this.
Where'd you gain all that weight?
Someone close to me passed away, and it had an effect on me.
You haven't seen her since she was 8 years old, and you're gonna reconnect with her?
Sorry.
I don't like this. This isn't a good idea.
I'm sorry.
You say you're sorry one more time, I will shove a knife right into you, I swear to God.
Go ahead, what's it gonna do? My internal organs are 2 feet in at least.
So this is The Whale, Darren Aronofsky's latest, starring Brendan Fraser. Before we talk about that, Layla, shall we have a listen to what Brendan and Darren had to say when Matt Matum sat down with them earlier this week to discuss their film?
Thanks very much for joining us today. And before we start, huge congratulations are in order because as we record this, The Whale has just been nominated for 4 BAFTA awards. The Whale is a film that's been introduced to the world in a way via film festivals, premiering at Venice and then also playing at TIFF and the London Film Festival. How did you kind of find the experience of showing the film to the world in that way?
This is my typical journey. I'm a film festival guy because I make these independent films. But this was a new trip for Brendan in many ways because he did the big, he's the big Hollywood flashy movie. So how was it for you, Brendan?
This is a first for me. Venice was the first time I'd seen it with a proper audience. I'd only seen it by myself. To have the response from that house was meaningful.
I mean, I've been at Venice with a few films and there was definitely a different feeling in the room that was super exciting. Everyone was excited to see Brendan there. And also, you know, the London one was hilarious because on the way to the London Film Festival, I was telling a story about how I went to see Matthew Bourne's Play Without Words. I guess it was at the National Theater or something. And that when it ended, I was right in the middle of the audience and I jumped up on my feet to give a standing ovation like a silly American. And I was the only person standing. And I had this decision to make, like either I sit back down and like I'm a sucker or I'm just going to stand up and keep playing. And I stood up and I tell that story to be like, you know, London audiences generally don't give standing ovations. And then when it ended at the BFI festival, they just went, I've never seen a standing ovation like that. And I think it was the first one and they couldn't remember the last time they had a standing ovation like that. So it was great. It was a great feeling to have that type of love. And that's why we're so excited that the movie is in theaters because it really is a go to the movie type of thing. And it's that old feeling of like to laugh and to cry together that has sort of not been at the movies for a long time.
And so for this type of film, is that important, do you think, to get that festival sort of love behind it?
Look, it's the only way to launch a small film and also then to get the award recognition that we've been lucky enough to get. People ask me about the awards and really the awards are most important for little films like The Whale, films that can't compete with all of the noise out there put out by big films as well as everything that's going on in the world. We just don't have the budgets for it, but winning awards and having a chance to sell our films through other people paying for it is what gets us out there. And that's the same thing with festivals.
Darren, what was it about Brendan that made him write for your Charlie in this film? Because I know you kind of, it took you a long time to sort of find the right actor.
It's hard to explain sometimes when a role and a character line up. You know, there's all those famous stories about, oh, Tom Cruise was going to play that role and it got replaced by that actor and it would have been... You hear those millions of stories, but I always feel like I kind of believe in the casting gods and that eventually they will reveal the way to the Holy Mountain. And it just took me a long time because, as Brendan said at the Critic Awards the other night, he was in the forest and he was no one was really thinking about him for a bit. And I was just lucky enough to stumble on him and then just had that gut feeling. And then when we put the words into his mouth, it was just clear that he was going to do this and do it in a very unique way.
And Brendan, how did working with Darren compare with any expectations you might have had based on his previous films?
I was a fan of his work. When I met Darren, I felt, I'll admit, to some creative intimidation, but he's just another guy and wants to create good work and do the best job possible. He's an excellent collaborator. He summons really top shelf and talented people, rally around Darren. He has a team that believe in what we're doing, all in 100% from every department. I love being a part of a company. That's what I felt I was joining, given how we approached the process with a 3-week rehearsal to make all my mistakes and discoveries and acquaintances and bonding with the other cast members and just sort of get confident with what we were doing, because going from, you know, the cozy environment of a rehearsal stage to the build meant we really have to do it and bring the best of what you got and perform this as you would do as a live production, as if it's the first and last time you ever will. And Darren created an environment that it had all just the greatest hits of everything in the way that I like to work. And I love makeup. I've always been fascinated with the craft of filmmaking, and that aspect of it is something that I kind of came of age of in the 90s with different kinds of prosthetic makeups. Mm. And to see that this is a process developed by Adrian Moreau that incorporates a 3D model, a virtual model, appliances that are digitally printed, and from that molds made so that they're absolutely seamless and undetectable. It's such a success, because in absence of that, we wouldn't have a movie. You just, you know, because we have to create Charlie from not just the inside out through a rehearsal process, but the outside in. And it has to be authentic in every aspect, or as close to as you can, because if you're wearing an outfit and a wardrobe and costume that defies gravity and physics, that's a mistake. And we've seen that in film so many times before The Whale. We knew what not to do.
Was there like an intensive testing process to get the makeup right, or did it come together quite quickly with like the expert team you had?
He was the first guy on. Adrian, he started super early, and it took a very long time with lots of tests and lots of new technology, a lot of invention. What he did never has been done before on this scale, and it just took someone like Adrian to figure it out.
He just uses really kind of like whatever works. For instance, Charlie's health deteriorates over the time that we see him over the 5 days, and to, you know, have that degradation of constitution, he gets a little lighter, a little more gray, a little more ashen, and Adrian had figured a way to gradate that skin tone in the appliances by using the dyes from Sharpie pens, you know, like squeezing it in the mix, whatever works, and it worked brilliantly. So that meant, you know, it's permanent, there's no touching up, I can sweat on it, etc., etc., etc. So I mean, he's just a mad cobbler and just does brilliant things from it. You just don't see the process. Mm. You just see the results. And it would have, in his mind, been a failure if you noticed any of the seams or the dotted lines, because then it would take you right out of the story.
And is it hard to act underneath it as well? Do you kind of have to modulate your sort of expressions, or does it all just kind of completely move with you?
Yeah, truthfully, I didn't really think about that much. If there was something that needed to be, like, I relied on everyone else to tell me, no, like, remember, keep your foot tucked in a certain way, because there's the research supports that people with larger bodies and legs like that, they have issues with rolling ankles. Mm. I learned quickly from Darren that there has to be some sort of sentience inside Charlie's body. Otherwise, if he's still in his limbs, then he kind of comes off as sort of artificial, or maybe like, I don't know, a mannequin arm or something like that. So I had to give him a little fingers and characteristics of rubbing his fingers together, just to put some energy into it. It was a cumbersome makeup for sure, and it should have been as good and appropriate, because it informed the way that he ambulates. I mean, he has clear mobility issues, so anything to help that along the way was really helpful.
These days, some people are very sensitive about people being cast outside of their own life experience, I suppose you could say. Did you kind of expect any of those reactions when you started working on this film?
I knew that it would be eye-opening to some individuals. There are those who are going to have their mind made up before they walk into this movie, and they're going to have their own ideas about how it should be made, what it is about, is it authentic, is it not, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, we know that the work that we did was infinitely researched. and supported by the Obesity Action Coalition, who are an advocacy group who support tens of thousands of people, who gave us notes on sensitivity issues, and their mission statement is to end weight bias. And I took it on board to deputize myself to tell their story with as much dignity and authenticity as I could. If there was anyone who thinks that they could have done it better, I don't know, get a better agent. I don't know what to tell them. It's a performance at the end of the day. And I do believe in inclusion. I do believe in representation as being important, but I have mixed feelings about it. And that in the final analysis, it's whatever works best to get on the screen to tell the story is what's most important.
With what you talked about your research, what were some of the kind of, was there anything you learned about people living with severe obesity that really kind of either surprised you?
I learned that you can't be mean to children. You can't say things to them about their appearance at a very early age because they'll hang on to it and grow into adults. And it sets a chain reaction in motion that can lead to habits such as, I don't know, pick the greatest hits of whatever your vice is. You're going to have a feeling of trying to fulfill something and always not being able to obtain it. And in this case with Charlie, he eats not for pleasure, but compulsively for a whole host of complicated reasons. It's never really explained why, and it's not that important. This isn't a movie about obesity. It's a story about a man who wants to connect with his daughter and how difficult that would be, and our hope for his redemption if he does.
It's a very sort of confined film as well in terms of time and space. Like, does that make it an extra challenge to shoot, or is there something kind of freeing about that?
I think it's both. I think it's the challenge of being in a confined space and making it cinematic was my big challenge and my goal. That was one of the best compliment I've got about the film, outside of how well the performers do, is that people kind of forget that they're in one space. And that was the great challenge of the piece. And, you know, I like having constraints, and that leads to a lot of freedom within those constraints.
Okay, so that's Brendan and Darren talking about The Whale. Layla, set it up for us, for those of us that are not aware what this is about.
So this is about a kind of reclusive English professor who struggles with obesity. Ever since his partner passed away, he has sort of been in a bit of a spiral. He doesn't leave his apartment. He has one friend that comes to see him, who's played by the marvelous Hong Chau. And he decides, as he kind of feels that, you know, he's not long for this world, that he wants to reconnect with his teenage daughter, who's played by Sadie Sink. There's also strangely a bit of a, there's like a missionary from like a strange cult that also appears. But yeah, it's based on a play, so the action is kind of quite faithful to the play. We stay within this apartment with Charlie, because he doesn't leave. And it's the Renaissance is on, I suppose. Like, Brendan Fraser is back, and, you know, he's just gotten his nomination for the Oscar, quite, you know, rightly so. And I think everybody's enjoying watching his speeches and, you know, the little clips and how emotional he gets that he's kind of had this incredible comeback.
Yes, it's a tricky film to discuss because I didn't love it. I see that it is excellent in terms of performance, and certain aspects of the writing I enjoyed, but I felt like it really was button pushing, and Aronofsky is cynically almost mining this particular character's grief for audience empathy and in some ways revulsion that didn't really sit well with me. The score's incredibly sort of manipulative and over-egged, and it felt very much static, like a play that had just been transposed to a film. So while I get the enjoyment of Fraser's performance and, you know, Sadie Sink being this little firecracker daughter, it really felt like I could see it on the page, and it didn't feel emotionally organic to me. Did you like it? Did it do it for you?
I think I liked it a little more than you. To me, it was Brendan Fraser so good in it that you know, I just enjoyed watching his performance so much. And to me, he was better than the film that kind of surrounded him. But it's definitely going to be a film that is very difficult for a lot of people. I know some people that found it, like, in its portrayal of people that struggle with obesity, very upsetting, and thought it was very cruel. I actually thought it wasn't. I felt like the film has a lot of love for Charlie, and I don't think that it was kind of looking at him with disgust, even when other characters are kind of treating him appallingly. But yeah, I mean, not his finest. I would say it's kind of got quite a lot of in common with The Wrestler, and I think The Wrestler is a better film. But worth seeing, I think, just to kind of see this wonderful comeback, because I think Brendan Fraser, people forgot what a good actor he is. But, you know, we kind of remember The Mummy and George of the Jungle and stuff, but, you know, things like The Quiet American, like he's actually always been
Gods and Monsters, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, he is really good. And his genuine sort of goodness that you sort of get a sense of from him as a person shines through in this role. And that Charlie is this lovely, lovely man who wants to see the best in people. And that's his absolute guiding light, that he really, really wants to see the best in people. That's a wonderful trait to watch. But it does feel like there's simplification going on about eating disorders, which, again, I understand from people I know who have struggled with this, that it feels glib. And so that might be troubling for people who are currently in this situation to watch this. I also couldn't quite decide, and I didn't know if this was direction or script, whether I was supposed to like Sadie Sink's daughter and think that she had made any kind of emotional turnaround within this film. It didn't give me enough to go on, and I felt frustrated by that.
Yeah, there is a really funny line that I won't spoil that Samantha Morton delivers about her daughter. Samantha Morton's brilliant, and there she comes in. She's Charlie's ex. I actually found Sadie Sink's character to be a weak point for me, because I couldn't really get what her problem was a lot of the time, which is, you know, maybe me being a little unfair, because obviously Charlie has not been a good father to this person. I suppose it's that thing, because Brendan Fraser is so lovable, and you're just like, but you'd forgive him. You'd be like, this poor man who's clearly not coping well with life. It seems to be a strange one. It hasn't divided, I think, down the lines that I would expect, because I know people who have, you know, histories with disordered eating, and some of them have been like, oh, I think this is like wonderfully empathetic. And, you know, there's a scene that where he kind of gets very upset, and so he just goes straight to the fridge. And that for me was really uncomfortable. But then I spoke to a friend of mine who'd had bulimia, and she said, like, no, that's what it's like, that desire to kind of binge and just kind of take food to kind of suppress a feeling. So yeah, but then others really offended by it and don't like it at all in terms of its portrayal. So it's a difficult one to recommend, because I don't want anyone to go into a film and be really upset. But yeah, if Fraser wins that Academy Award, I think he's as good an actor and a performance that has won it of late.
So is he the front runner, do we think? I mean, it's interesting that he has been nominated in numerous awards, but the film hasn't done as well, and neither has Aronofsky. In terms of awards, the awards are really telling audiences that this performance is a thing to see this film for. Is Brendan Fraser the front runner?
I think it's between him and Colin Farrell, isn't it? And I kind of wouldn't begrudge either of those things happening, because, I mean, I just rewatched Banshees the other day, and just Colin Farrell's eyebrows are absolutely incredible. But yeah, I mean, he's in a lot of prosthetics. He doesn't get to move around a lot. So it really has to kind of be sold just on his face. And I don't think that's a very easy thing to do at all. Colin had, you know, lovely Jenny the Donkey to help kind of
and beautiful be the emotional vistas. Part of his film.
Yeah. So yeah, very deserving. But I think even if he doesn't win it, I think he's going to get a lot of exciting roles off the back of this, because he's really shown what he can do.
Yeah. And so from that point of view, it's well worth seeing, just to see there's an epiphany and a transformation within this film that we're also seeing echoed in life and in career in Brendan Fraser. So from that point of view, it is worth watching. So that is The Whale, and that is in cinemas from Friday. So finally, we discussed donkeys earlier. It's time for another donkey film. It's this one. Okay, so this is Io. Layla, it's sort of a warhorse with a donkey, isn't it?
Yeah, I suppose it's kind of a bit smaller than that, but then I suppose that makes sense, because a donkey is smaller than a horse. Yeah, this is a film that is kind of a remake of a Robert Bresson film called O Hazard Balthazar, which I haven't seen, so I can't really compare. the two. But yeah, this was a Cannes favorite, and it's a kind of told from the point of view of a donkey that kind of starts off in this Polish circus, and then we see the kind of donkey's kind of goes on a hero's journey. I don't know how you'd even describe it, but we follow this donkey. So he goes to different situations. They at times in sanctuaries, at times in really like horribly abusive spaces. If you don't want to see violence depicted on donkeys, I'd avoid.
Or other animals. I mean, there's a fur farm involved as well.
It's not an easy watch for animal lovers, but 10 minutes in, I was just like, this is just going to be about this donkey. I watched Gunda last year, which was just about a pig, and I did find that a bit kind of overstretched. But yeah, the adventures of Io are actually really quite interesting. And it's quite interesting because the way that he depicted it, I thought it might be a bit kind of saccharine and kind of like, ooh, look at this lovely donkey. But you do really understand the animal's perspective, where it's like, humans aren't actually that interested in him a lot of the time. Like, he's not kind of treated like a person in a way that another film might do. I'm describing this very strangely, but it is a very unusual little film. But yeah, he's dismissed quite a lot of the time. There's a lot of cruelty that happens to him. And he sort of goes through the world almost like a bit of a shadow. Like, often in scenes he's being like entirely ignored, but he's kind of observing these things around him. I mean, I was surprised that this was nominated for Best International Feature Film. I mean, not only because Saint-Omer didn't do it, but it's such a strange little film that at times, you know, there's a bit where Isabelle Huppert appears, which is quite surreal.
And starts throwing plates about. No apparent reason.
But I guess that's the power of the donkey. This is just really the year of the donkey, and we want to reward them with things.
Yeah, it is. It's 90 minutes. In fact, I think it's 1 hour, 28 minutes. It's a brisk watch. And it's sort of one of those, you know, mood board feeling films that I think anybody could watch. You don't actually really have to read any of the subtitles that happen. This donkey moves through different countries through Europe and meets all sorts of different people from different walks of life and observes humans' cruelty to each other and to animals, casual cruelty that happens and casual violence that happens to humans and animals. And so you do get a lot of different languages on the screen, but I actually think you could just watch this just from the visuals and the soundtrack and the beautiful cinematography and understand this journey. It kind of reminded me of the little boy's journey in The Painted Bird, in as much as that it's a long journey across Europe. He's sort of bobbed along by wherever the tide of humanity takes him, and horrific things happen to him and still he survives. But I think you have to read into it something. The director has sort of said this is about, you know, animal cruelty, and it's about understanding what we do to the creatures in our world and perhaps thinking about that a bit more. And if that is, you know, farming, fur farming, or farming animals for their meat or milk, then maybe we do need to think about that a bit more. And for me, my takeaway was I need to really seriously consider vegetarianism. So that's what I took from it. But you don't necessarily have to. You can literally watch it as a travelogue. This is a little donkey's travelogue across Europe, and some of the things are unpleasant, but he also sees great beauty in the world and, you know, gorgeous sunrises and sunsets and beautiful little bridges next to waterfalls, and there's great beauty in it as well as cruelty. So what did you take from it, Layla? Just donkeys?
Well, I mean, it made me think about my relationship with animals, certainly, and like how weird it is that humans feel that they have these kind of rights over these creatures that we're sharing the world with, and, you know, they're experiencing lives, and why do we feel that we have this power to kind of decide what that life should be? No, the vegetarianism thing is definitely creeping closer and closer. I've just, oh god, I'm gonna struggle to give up sushi. But like, a lot of these kind of lovely donkey performances do make you consider that these are very sweet little souls. But my dad also used to get around on a donkey, so it did make me think of him. He, you know, from I think about 8 till 16, he had a donkey, and that's how he would get around the kind of dusty streets of Khartoum. And I've never asked him what happened to that donkey, but he did say that eventually at 16 he got a bicycle and he was much happier with that. So
Less stubborn, a bicycle will actually go when you want it to, because there is some humour in this as well, we should say, that Io definitely has a personality, is a stubborn little donkey at times. There's a wonderful scene where he lives amongst beautiful racehorses and that are bred and gorgeous prancing animals. And he's sat in the background feeling like a little dumpy donkey. So he just wanders off and trashes all of the awards that are lined up on shelves. There are little sort of moments of humour and moments of triumph. The Isabelle Huppert moment felt very disconnected to me in this film because we've seen everything else through the donkey's eye. And then this interior scene happens whilst he's outside nuzzling at the grass. So I didn't really understand why that was in there. However, I do enjoy seeing her wearing high heels, looking fabulous and throwing plates about. But I didn't know why it was in this film.
It did feel a bit like, we got Isabelle Huppert, so we must use Isabelle Huppert.
Yeah.
That is one of the odder moments. And it is a bit more surreal also than the rest of it. So it did also feel kind of a bit tonally out of place. But yeah, I did leave wanting to read more about the production of the film. What I understand is that there were 6 donkey actors and they all have different personalities. And like, what would have that been like? Because you hear about how working with animals is a nightmare. Imagine working with 6 donkeys and like getting these performances out of them. But yeah, it's definitely sad donkey winter. And I think this is our final sad donkey of the year.
Well, I mean, who knows if Shrek's donkey gets something, maybe he'll have some sort of, you know, crisis of faith and it'll be a sad donkey there. Who knows? But yeah, we have had a donkey run, haven't we?
We have. And you think those 3 donkey films, Io, Triangle of Sadness and Banshees, all got Oscar nominations. So that's where perhaps Alice Diop didn't get recognition. Maybe
she should have had a donkey in it.
There you go.
Just sitting in court watching proceedings. Yeah. If Brendan Fraser wants to win his Oscar, maybe he needs to start hanging out with a donkey for photo calls. This is the way forward. The donkeys
that would break
have
the
it.
Internet. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, cool. We jest, but this is another film that I would say was quite profound and actually probably is my film of this week. So yes, Io is in cinemas now. Film of the week for you?
Saint-Omer, film of the week, film of the year. But yeah, I think this is a really strong week though. I mean, past podcasts, we normally have at least one where we're just like, oh, well, you know, wasn't quite. And I think every single one of these has got lots to recommend it.
Indeed, yes. Okay, so let us know which one you went to see because that's quite a wide range of different genres and styles going on there. But in the meantime, I should remind you that our current issue is out now. It's brand new. It's got John Wick Chapter 4 on the cover. And we have talked to Keanu Reeves about how this film is even more action-packed than the previous ones. And it is banana cakes levels of action. Does that excite you, Layla?
It really does. I mean, that's someone who, a bit like Brendan Fraser, I think there was an appreciation of just how great he is that happened a few years ago. And yes, always up for Keanu. But I've been overstating, but that is a movie star. Dave Bautista, Brendan Fraser, Keanu Reeves. These are
is
our
that
movie it? Stars.
Is that where you're drawing the line? There's no others?
Oh, no, there's a few others. I mean, Tom Cruise, definitely. Hopefully. I would say Idris Elba's in there. Mm.
I think that the measure is if you lined up a load of disparate people who were different ages from different backgrounds and different knowledge of cinema, if you said to them the same name and they all knew who it was, that's a movie star. And for me, Tom Cruise is ticks that box. Certainly Dave Bautista's not at that level yet. Tom Cruise is my marker for that. Just as Spielberg 100%. is the director that if you asked any number of people, do you know who Spielberg is? They do, but other directors, maybe not so much. So that's my science experiment for this week.
I would say Bautista, it's not necessarily that he's there, but it's more he has what it takes
potential.
To be that. Yeah, and he was saying that he really wants to do a romantic comedy, but he thinks that like he won't get cast in that sort of thing because of the way that he looks. And I just, you know, what is Hollywood doing if we're not putting Bautista in a romantic comedy? I would love that.
He has the ability to do tenderness. Knock at the Cabin shows that. So, you know, let's see. You can have that idea from us. Layla is... selling that idea, Dave Bautista in a rom-com. What kind of rom-com? He's a bookstore owner that upstate New York. What's the scenario?
I'm thinking that this, bookstore owner would work, but I think what we should do is get Nicole Holofcener, who did Enough Said, and I mentioned earlier her new film, You Hurt My Feelings, is wonderful because she did it so well with James Gandolfini.
Yes.
These guys that were kind of like, you know, not the stereotypical rom-com leads, but like, you're watching it and you are actually falling completely in love with this man. I love that James Gandolfini performance.
Me too. And I love her work. So, okay, there you go. That's a meeting that needs to be done. Get the agents together. Okay, we should remind you as well that if you like this podcast, you can make your life easier by subscribing. Just press that button now. And remember, we also have another podcast, Total Films Last Picture Show, where we ask a guest to choose four films to show on their last night at the pictures. This week, we're inviting former professional footballer and TV and radio pundit Michael Gray in the projector booth.
If it was the end of the world, it's difficult to actually narrow it down to four. But it would have to be Gladiator for me, absolutely. I mean, that's the one that, it's my go-to.
And as somebody who stood on, you know, football pitches in stadiums, do you kind of understand the thrill of Gladiator standing there saying, are you not entertained? Do you kind of get a sense of that as a footballer?
Absolutely. I mean, obviously an ex-footballer now, but when you're in stadiums and big full stadiums, I mean, you can see the arena. And I've actually done interviews and used this analogy as a comparison about being in that arena and, you know, you being the gladiator and want to, you know, walk down the tunnel after a game and knowing that you've given absolutely everything and you've won the game. And I suppose that's how you feel. It's got that feel where, you know, your shoulders are back, you're proud of what you've achieved.
No tigers on the field for you, luckily. Well,
no, I didn't quite come across any tigers. Maybe a couple of cats running across the football field when I was playing, but that was about the as close as I got to the tigers. But yeah, I mean, what a scene.
Find it on your podcast platform now.
I really love the Joe Cornish episode. I mean, I actually really like his new kind of YA show for Netflix, Lockwood and Co. But he was also just so interesting on, you know, the movies that he chose. I kind of found myself almost wanting to just kind of write it down just in case the apocalypse comes, because they were very good choices.
They were. And I loved that he chose Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, because that's one of my faves as well. So yes, if you want to listen to Joe Cornish's Last Picture Show, have a search for that as Total Films Last Picture Show on your podcast platform. Before we go, listener question incoming. If you could rent a movie house for your holidays, which one would you choose?
Okay, well, I would have to check the basement to make sure that there wasn't anyone down there. But I really, really want to go to Korea because, you know, I love Korean food. I love Korean cinema. And, you know, I've never been. And I actually really like the house in Parasite.
Yeah, it's cool. Like,
it's really cool. I love the stylish kind of outdoor garden. I love the way that they hang up artwork and stuff. I mean, I imagine that would be a very expensive Airbnb rental. So maybe you'd have to take, you know, somebody in the basement in order for them to kind of get it to a price that
just,
I could afford.
Yeah, just send some noodles down every so often to feed the person living there. Fine.
Yeah, or a baby bottle, which was probably one of the most disturbing details of that entire film when that man, sorry, spoilers for Parasite, but somebody drinks out of a baby's bottle and it is upsetting. But yeah, that gorgeous house.
Yeah, I'm going to go for the Perlman residence in Call Me By Your Name, because I really would like that very nice lady that cooks them those dinners outside every night to cook me some beautiful Italian food under the trees. I'd like to splash about in that little pool. It just felt idyllic, and cycle around the countryside on bikes, getting ice cream in town. That sounds like a delightful way to spend time. So yeah, I'd like to rent that, please. If Luca Guadagnino could arrange that, send me a rental form, Luca, and that'll be my summer. Yeah. Let us know if you have a holiday home in mind from the movies on Twitter. But for now, it's time to say goodbye. So say goodbye, Layla.
Bye.
Goodbye. I've got a lot of money. Caught in a rat race, terminally. I'm a professional cynic, but my heart's not in it. I'm paying the price of living life at the limit. Caught up in the centuries, anxiety. Yes, it plays on him. Watching up the new repeats and the permeates in the country. He takes a manner of pills and piles up on his bells in the country. Oh, it's like an animal farm, that's a little charming.